Thank you for the opportunity to speak here at Lancaster Seminary. My father spoke in 1982 on the topic of dialogue between religions. And so here I stand 31 years later. His was an invitation to new relationships with people of other religions. And today I'm going to be talking about an invitation to relationships with our partners around the world. Our family has enjoyed living on Pine Street since last September. And we've been blessed to revisit the many connections that we have. Many of them are family ties, but also the rich history of mission, the relationship of mission in Japan here in Lancaster. And as Carol pointed out, all you have to do is go to the back of the sanctuary and find Mount Fuji and the Shinto symbol for the torii. We are a living history of mission. The people that I work with know Lancaster. And it was people in this part of the country that started the churches that I have worked with for the past 22 years. And so they are eternally grateful for you, for your witness, for your continued partnership with them through Global Ministries. And I'm glad to say I represent that link that has continued for 126 years. It's still alive. I'm also honored to be able to give the Paul and Catherine lectureship. Paul, for a long time, was working for the United Church of Christ Global Missions. And so he was my parents' superior, the boss. From everybody that I've talked to, I've heard that Paul was such a pleasure to work with. And I'm aware that Paul and Kit are also a part of my family legacy. And so the connections are everywhere. And I thank you for this opportunity. So the topic for today is mission, God's mission in this world. And I will be speaking from my own experience of walking in partnership with our partners in Japan as it played out, especially in the disaster of March 11th, 2011. This word partnership has been around for a long time. It's not a new word. By partnership, we mean honoring and listening to each other, learning and sharing from each other. It also means sharing our joys and our pains, our struggles with each other. In another day, there might have been a time when we had all the power and the money to make the decisions about what ought to be done in the mission field. But today we use words like mutuality, relationship. In some of our churches here in the United States, people are beginning to see that, in fact, we are the ones that are thirsting for relationship. Our churches have lost that sense of our ties, the history. And I'm not here to talk about nostalgia, how things used to be, but it's just about who we are. The legacy that we carry within us. And so for Global Ministries, I work for the Common Global Ministries. And we call it Common because the United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ are joined together in Global Ministries. Two different churches, but we share in common Global Ministries. I've worked for Common Global Ministries for the past 22 years. And in Global Ministries, we want to hold on to the 270 international partners that we have around the globe. Lancaster Seminary has played a leading role in nurturing that history of relationship. I hope that through the stories that I have to tell today, I can help to enliven your imagination for what it would be like to renew those relationships with God's people around the world. These past months, I have been traveling around the U.S., visiting many churches in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Washington, California, Missouri. I've met graduates of Lancaster, Ed Evans in Washington State, Rebecca Brayan in upstate Pennsylvania. Each 4 years, I come back to do this, to share the stories about how God is working through our partners. And it's been exciting, both exciting and difficult this time around. Exciting to think that in 126 years, I just happened to be there when disaster struck. This way. Sorry. I was blessed to be able to represent you, to be the face of the international community wanting to reach out in a time of need, and just happen to be living and working with our partners at a time when they needed that assurance that we are with you, that our ties are still strong. And Common Global Ministries came through with funding that comes from One Great Hour of Sharing, our church's wider mission, Week of Compassion, Disciples Mission Fund, and these funds came and helped our relief effort. So that's an exciting part to be telling our churches. The difficult part is to revisit and to talk about the suffering that is ongoing in Japan. I hurt for Japan. Sometimes I'm close to tears. I never know when the tears will come. When I think about the suffering that has been unleashed by the nuclear disaster. The Japanese people have become my people. I carry their struggles with me. I also carry their strong Christian witness with me. It has been encouraging to see how people in the churches here have prayed for Japan. People have shared tears with me for Japan. People have thanked me for bringing the truth of what is really happening in Fukushima. One young lady who is not even a church member, she just had this passion for Japan. She came to one of the sessions and she gave me a hug and she said, "I lost my husband a year ago. I know what loss feels like. You've got to take care of yourself." She became the wounded healer to me, entering into our pain through her own. It has been my role to be that bridge between peoples and churches. So for today, I've chosen 15 pictures for us to enter into. The first will be about the earthquake, the tsunami, and our relief efforts. The latter part
will focus on nuclear issues. Here we have a picture of our volunteers bicycling out to the coast soon after the disaster of 2 years ago. I hope you've picked up the printout. On the back, you'll find a map of Japan. You can find Sendai on the northeastern coast. Sendai lies along the Pacific coast and was one of the areas hit by the sizable earthquake. Fortunately, both my home and my workplace, called the Emmaus Center, were far enough from the coast so that we were not affected by the tsunami. However, we could hop on a bicycle and be down here by the coast in a matter of 40 minutes. Within days after the earthquake, my workplace became a relief center, and our partner church, the Kyodan, the United Church of Christ in Japan, which is not the same as the United Church of Christ in this country. The United Church of Christ in Japan is made up of former Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, Congregational, Reformed, Canada, lots of North American churches in one. So it's truly a united church. Our partner church mobilized nationally to send volunteers out to the coast to help with mud removal and anything that we could do. I want you to look at their backs. What do you think they carry with them? Do you think they knew, these young volunteers knew, what it was they had to offer? Many of the young volunteers just felt compelled to jump into action. They needed to go and see for themselves and just to lend a helping hand. But once they got out there to see the devastation and the suffering of the people, many returned full of sadness, anger, confusion, a sense of helplessness, and questions about life and death. They didn't know how to process what they had seen. What does this mean? What am I doing here? Can I make a difference at all? The city of Sendai has a population of 1 million. This is where the German Reformed Church of America started sending missionaries more than 120 years ago. And Lancaster was at the center of all that. There they started churches, established two schools, one for boys, one for girls. A school for girls at a time when there were no schools for girls. They started a seminary. And then 60 years ago, the ENR Church. I always grew up hearing about the ENR. I never really understood what it was until later. But somehow my mother was from the R and my father was from the E. The ENR Church started a youth center to reach out to college-age young people. And this youth center actually became my workplace, where I've worked for 22 years. Most of the youth I work with have no ties to the church. It is an outreach ministry of the Japanese church. So you can see, it was by no coincidence that I was living in Sendai when the disaster struck. Now I want you to imagine this large city, stripped of electricity, water, gas. No phone lines, no cell phones worked. Food items scarce, because all the roads and the trains are shut down. People had to line up for hours just to receive two items from the grocery store. No gasoline was to be found. So life, as we knew it, was suddenly gone. It is a humbling experience to suddenly lose the things you depend on. But we also learned so much in those days. We learned that when everything is stripped from you, what remains? Everything you depend on is gone. What remains is relationships, community, each other. As I drive through areas east of here in Burden Hand, I have this special affinity for the Amish. I think if everything shut down, they would come through strong. I feel really close to them. There's some truth in their life. So we had each other. Relationships are the resource we nurture for times like this. Just a minute, I want to go to the fourth picture first. The Emmaus Center became like a grand central station with young volunteers coming and going all the time. Some came for 3 days, others for longer periods. We hosted 2,500 volunteers, 80% of whom did not belong to the church. And I can tell you that it was the 60 years of outreach to young people, non-Christian young people, that provided us the relationships, the trust that went beyond the church, so that a time when crisis hit, everybody came to our Emmaus Center looking for what they could do. And our effort became much larger than the church. The Emmaus Center's only 4 staff. But we were allowed to do something very big, thanks to all of the people from beyond the boundaries of the church who trusted us, who wanted to work with us. And I came to think, oh, isn't it great? Isn't the church at its best when it's a sign of something larger than itself? When the church is not the answer, but the church is a sign, we can be a sign of something larger than ourselves. So these 2,500 volunteers, we fed them, we housed them, we put them out on bicycles to go out to the coast. This picture shows, oh, I'm sorry. Oops. Sorry about this. This picture shows volunteers at the end of the day in a meeting. They share about the work that they had done, how many volunteers went to each house, what was the content of their work, how many volunteers will be needed the next day. And then after this, we would break them up into small groups of 10, and we would tell them to share what's on your heart. This, we said, is not a time for conversation or debate. It's not a time to flaunt your knowledge. Pastors have a way of doing that. It is a space to listen to each other, a place to be heard, and a place to honor the feelings of others. You might know the Japanese people are not accustomed to opening up in front of strangers. But the volunteers had seen too much.
there were many issues weighing on their hearts they didn't know what to do with. The time of sharing became what I would like to say like a sanctuary, a safe space, where they discovered that it's okay not to have the answers. It's okay to be broken. It's okay to be vulnerable. And through this time of sharing, the volunteers came upon something very beautiful. I like to say that it's that beautiful treasure God has put in every human heart that is just waiting to be shared. It doesn't matter who you are, what your accomplishments are. In every human heart, a treasure that's just waiting to be shared with others. And when you wake up to that treasure in yourself or in others, miracles happen. Notice that our staff are all young. We learned as we went along. It's called learning by doing. One day our volunteers had a discussion when about a month or two after the earthquake, gasoline started becoming available. So we said, well, we could use cars to go down to the coast. And late into the night, the volunteers were saying, no. We want to continue to go by bicycles because we know that the survivors have lost so much. They have suffered so much. And we will never be able to understand how much they've suffered. But we want to walk as closely to their suffering as we can. And so we want to take on this extra labor. Bicycle 40 minutes down, work all day, bicycle 40 minutes back. We want that extra labor as a sign of our commitment to walk as closely with them as we can. That's beautiful. The man on the left is a carpenter named Mr. Sugawara. He's standing with one of our volunteers. Mr. Sugawara's house had been hit by the tsunami, and he had lost his mother. His workplace had been completely destroyed, and Mr. Sugawara had evacuated to an elementary school where he was staying with about 300 villagers. One day, soon after the tsunami, one of our young pastors from the Emmaus Center hopped on his bicycle to go out to the coast to see what he could do for the survivors. He met Mr. Sugawara, and in the course of their conversation, the young pastor said something which has remained with me ever since. Imagine what you would say if you met a survivor. This young Japanese pastor said, "Mr. Sugawara, we are looking for hope, and we want to share this hope with our young people. Would you help us?" Isn't that beautiful? The young pastor asked Mr. Sugawara for help, as if to say, "You're the one that's going to lead us to hope." He put the ball in Mr. Sugawara's hand and said, "Unless you find hope, we don't find hope." Mr. Sugawara's eyes lit up. He just happened to be the chair of the local little league, and he loved working with young people. And he said, "Okay, you follow me." And he took us on beyond the police and the National Defense Forces into the village where people were not normally allowed to go in. He said, "I'm going to take responsibility for these guys." And then he turned to us and he said, I got to warn you, I don't like Christians, and I don't care for volunteers. But there's something about you guys, I like you. I'm going to trust you. You do my front yard. You don't have to do it quickly, but do a good job. And the neighbors just might ask you to help. This was the beginning of a beautiful relationship with the people of Shichigo village. Mr. Sugawara became our contact person in the village. Every morning, our volunteers would arrive on their bicycles, and Mr. Sugawara would point us, okay, 5 in that house, 8 in that house. Eventually, we were able to help with all 117 households. They even asked us to help with their gravesite, their Buddhist graves, where their ancestors rest. These people do not know the Bible. They don't know the Emmaus story. But they would say, Emao, Emao, that's how you say it in Japanese. Thank you, Emmaus Center. Thank you for being here. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here. And then at the end of a year, they gave us a prefab in their village. And they said, we want you to be a permanent part of our village as we rebuild. Such trust you can never ask for. Christians in Japan are 1% of the population. This means that the dominant culture doesn't understand you, doesn't want to honor you sometimes, and acts as though you ought to conform to the ways of the dominant culture. Holding on to the faith can be much like trying to stay afloat in a storm. This is a Japanese woodblock print of the disciples crossing the Sea of Galilee with Jesus. I have learned so much from the struggles of our partners. It's not easy to be small, to be a minority. Through them, I learned about the patience, the courage, and trust needed to keep true to the faith. Japan, for the most part, is a secular society. People do not ascribe to a personal faith. However, the two religions of Buddhism and Shintoism are much alive. When there is a death in the family, people go to the Buddhist temple. And when there is a birth, a wedding, or anything to do with life, people ask for a Shinto ritual. Buddhism and Shintoism do not compete because they have different roles in society, life and death. Religion is alive in the sense that traditions are important to the people. And so the statement, I don't like Christians, this is an attitude I often encounter in my work with young people. They say religious people, this is the perception, religious people are narrow-minded, judgmental, intolerant, and self-serving. That behind Jeffrey's nice smile and his very gentle demeanor, there must be an ulterior motive to get us into his fold. Christianity is always trying to expand its sphere of influence. And they say religion is often the cause of war. So it has been my challenge to present a different face of Christianity that is tolerant of other religions, open to listening to others. I try to share that there are Christians who think that war is a sign of failed diplomacy and that it is a poor way to solve conflict. So when I receive a blunt statement like, "I don't care for Christians," I see that as an opportunity to enter into a new relationship. And oftentimes, these relationships can last and help us to grow in our understanding of one another. Again, it's all about relationships. Relationships are God's way of working miracles in our life. On the 11th of each month at 2:46, people from the Emmaus Center gather out by the coast to hold hands for a minute of silence. In our circle are people from the Tendikyo sect. There are also young people who would call themselves secular. No matter what our religious or spiritual background, we hold hands to remember the dead and pray for those who continue to struggle. We are much aware that on this land where we are praying, it was reported about 300 people died. You would be surprised how much the young volunteers value this time of silent vigil. They told me they appreciated religious communities for the rituals and the practices, the language that they have, that rich history that brings comfort to a wider audience. And it was exciting to see how Buddhists and Christians came together to pray for the dead and to care for the grieving. Through this circle, the young people find comfort in knowing that they belong to a fellowship of people who continue to pray and lift up the lives of those who suffer. So in a secular society, the role of the church, maybe we really find our voice when disaster strikes. Maybe that's when, even though we're a small group, that's when people can really appreciate the church or the religious communities. This is 83-year-old Mr. Konno showing me his string beans last summer. Look at his smile. He has been a farmer all his life, and after the tsunami destroyed his farm, Mr. Konno lost all incentive to live. His wife thought he would go become senile and die. The Konno family was one that was determined not to depend on the help of volunteers. They were a proud farming family. If anything goes wrong on the farm, you don't go asking strangers. Depending on strangers is shameful. It's just not a part of our history, they would say. But one day, 2 months or so after the earthquake, they decided to try it. Let's have some volunteers come and just help outside. Soon, Mr. Konno snapped back to life. He enjoyed having these young college girls coming every day. And he could tell them what to do, and they would listen to his long stories. He was a very condescending sort of man. He would just like grunt and tell us where to do, what to do, and what to go, and force us to drink coffee. His wife told me how amazed she was to see the change in him. And one day she leaned over the counter and looked into my eyes, and she said, "You know, I don't know why they do this for us. We are complete strangers. And if there was a disaster in another part of the country, I don't believe our people would go to this length to help strangers." And as she looked into my eyes, I didn't feel I needed to answer anything. That there was already something opening up in her heart. Her understanding of family as blood relatives was expanding to that sense of the human family. She had witnessed the goodness in every human heart that is just waiting to be shared. Now the discussion shifts to the nuclear disaster. You can find, this is part of the Japanese map. If you want to look at your map, let's see. This is Sendai. And this is Tokyo, okay? So if you look at your map, you can see the Fukushima disaster is right between Sendai and Tokyo. And because the Fukushima disaster is between Sendai and Tokyo, all of the train lines and the roads are shut down. I never realized how everything is dependent on Tokyo. The first explosion happened on March 12th, the following day, and the plume flew up here to Iwate. Kit Gregory would know Okunakayama. As you may know, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plants exploded several times following the earthquake. One fact that was clear from the beginning was that neither the TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Company, nor the Japanese government was capable of managing the situation and protecting the public. The nuclear plumes not only released large amounts of radiation into the air and sea, but they have caused much anxiety and fear for the people. There's so much to say about this topic, but I want to limit this to comments to how our partners are responding in this state of emergency. And for those of you who want to learn more, I would direct you to look up the website for the Helen Caldicott Foundation. Helen Caldicott is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. And this Helen Caldicott Foundation sponsored an international symposium in New York on the second anniversary, about a month ago, in New York City. And everything's on their website. So that'd be a good source to go to, the Helen Caldicott Foundation. The situation is much worse than anybody would like to believe. Although the government announced a safety declaration in December of 2011, those living in and around Fukushima know that this is far from the truth. Pipes from Unit 2 are corroded and leaking, releasing large amounts of radiation into the environment. Next to Unit 4, there is an exposed pool of water in which there are 1,500 rods of spent fuel. If anything were to happen to this pool of water, Japan would be left uninhabitable. Our local Northeastern Conference has arranged for an emergency alert system to alert all 88 churches in the conference in the event of an emergency in Unit 4. The government has downplayed the dangers. They have sent in their experts and scientists to control the situation. They are trying to educate the public with new standards of safety, standards which would have been highly unacceptable prior to the disaster. The government prioritizes economic stability and recovery. They promise the people of Fukushima that they will be able to return to their homes. They provide money for people who have lost land, homes, and livelihood. As the days wear on, the general public gets tired of living in fear. They say, I don't want to think about this anymore. I want to eat when I want to eat. I want to live the life that I want to live. And they stop thinking about it. And they want to believe that they will be able to go back to their ancestral land. You might as well commit suicide if you lose the family farm. And so the government plays into this psychology. And as the noose tightens, those who question the new official line are isolated and made to feel as if they are the ones that are overreacting. This picture shows a gamma ray spectrometer, which measures radiation in food items, water, and soil. There are also Geiger counters, which allow you to measure the amount of radiation in the air. What is happening in Japan today is that people are making their own measurements. There's a group of concerned citizens, of which the church is also centrally involved, which does not trust the official measurements. And with funding from Common Global Ministries, and maybe some of you are from the Methodist Church, the Methodist Church has a wonderful unit called UMCOR, which is focused on disasters. And they have been wonderful also in supporting our partners with machines like this. And our partners provide services free to the public so people can walk in and measure their breast milk, measure their water, their soil, and feel safe about what they're eating. The young lady on my left is Tomoko. She is 22 years old from Fukushima City, where the radiation levels are high. Tomoko now works in Sendai, but she loves to go home to Fukushima and love her and eat her mother's cooking. Her mother uses vegetables from the garden that Grandpa and Grandma helped to make. She sits down at the dinner table and just casually says, I wonder if this is safe to eat. That simple question ruins the evening. Nobody can talk about the subject rationally. And so Tomoko learns not to talk about it. Radiation is the white elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. Tomoko would like to have her own family one day, but her parents and her grandparents are unable to entertain her simple questions. The insidious thing about radiation is that it not only destroys our bodies. My wife over the internet just shared with me that there's a farm in Fukushima where the horses are just dropping dead day after day, and nobody knows why. Not only does radiation destroy our bodies, but it destroys human relationships in the family, at the workplace, as well as in society. People are afraid. People don't know what to think. Nobody's on top of the situation. and people are deeply polarized by the money that comes in from the government. Fukushima is a polarized disaster zone. This is Terumi, a member of the Aizu Wakamatsu Church in Fukushima. Notice the German Reformed look to her church. She heads a citizen group called the Aizu Radiation Information Center that strives to protect the people of Fukushima. They sponsor refreshment camps for children to escape the high radiation zones for short periods of time, so that children can play outside free of the fear of radiation. It pained me to teach my children, to tell my children, don't play in the leaves, because radiation sticking to water has a way of sort of collecting in the leaves. Don't play in the puddles. Think of the fear that parents have to teach their children. Terumi's group also brings concerned parents together to share about their concerns. They share information and provide a support group for local parents who question the official line. They also join rallies and advocate for the children and residents in Fukushima. They speak out against a government that keeps the truth from the public, thereby putting lives at risk. And every Friday evening, in front of the Prime Minister's office, anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000 people demonstrate against Japan's dependence on nuclear energy. I'll bet you nobody in this room knows about that. It doesn't get out of Japan. This groundswell of opposition within Japan. The media has completely shut it out. These days, you have to go looking for the information. You can't just wait in front of a television screen. Terumi shared with me her decision to evacuate soon after the nuclear explosion. Nobody knew how bad this was going to be. She thought by setting an example, others would be encouraged to escape as well. However, when she arrived at her relative's house in southern Japan, she felt terrible. Though her family consoled her, saying, "You did the right thing," she could not feel right about her decision. And that night, she sat down to have dinner. And the image of Christ sharing the meal with the two disciples on the way to Emmaus came to her. And she saw herself in the shoes of the disciples. She saw the cross for what it was. She had turned her back on the people of Fukushima. She also understood the meaning of forgiveness in Christ. So she returned to serve her people. She stands as a strong advocate for the people who are walking in darkness in Fukushima. For her and her people who are fighting the monolithic systems of our government, international relationships, the relationships I'm talking about today, are crucial. I asked her, "What would you like me to tell folks in the United States?" She responded, "We want people to learn about what is really happening in Fukushima. We want people to know the truth." The road to recovery will take time. For most people, their lives will never be the same. Life has changed. As the majority of society moves on with their lives, the clock has stopped for people in Fukushima, Miyagi, people hit by the tsunami. They have not only lost their homes, their family, their jobs, but also their daily life. The simple things in life that bring meaning and joy, what would that be in your life? Like a little garden. Or Thanksgiving. Those little things, you lose the motivation even to think about it. And so the Emmaus Center is there to say, what brings meaning to your life? We'll do it with you. And just having that one person say that helps them to regain their daily life. But recently, there's one more thing that I've been reading a book called Dignity by Donna Hicks. And survivors lose a sense of dignity because all of a sudden, they're on the receiving end of people's aid. And they wonder, why do we always have to receive things from people? And these are proud Japanese people. They lose their dignity. And so that young pastor's question to Mr. Sugawara, would you help us? That question puts dignity back into his hands. You are just as much an important part of this problem as we are. And we're going to make it through together. And maybe our relief activities are all about putting dignity back into the lives of the people who have lost that. Here you can see some of our volunteers taking flowers to the people of Shichigo. We want to show them that we care for them and will continue to walk with them. But this is not about a one-way relationship. I think we all learned that relationships are mutually enriching. As much as the survivors were grateful to meet our volunteers, our young volunteers were deeply grateful for the relationship with the survivors. It was as if we were looking into one another's eyes, saying, you are my hope. You bring me hope. The young girl in the middle is Hisako, age 19. In a sharing session, she said, I feel I have learned in 1 week what it would have taken me a year to learn at home. I finally know what it means to serve others. It means that they allow you to grow as a human being, and that feels good. And as soon as she said that, all the other volunteers started clapping because they could really resonate with her sharing. We offer ourselves because this is all that we have to offer. And when we find authentic relationship, we see that it has the power to change us for the good. Maybe this is what the Holy Spirit does for us. Maybe the Holy Spirit is a fancy word for relationship. A relationship you look back upon and you say, boy, didn't our hearts just burn when we walked that road together? Now for my closing remarks about mission. Many people think that mission is about what happens over there, across the seas, or in other lands. People think that mission is about helping poor people. But I ask you, what if mission was less about what we did for others, and more about who we are? If mission was about our identity. Jean Vanier, the founder of the L'Arche community in France, has a beautiful line. He says, love is not about doing something for others. Love is being able to find something beautiful in others. Love is not about what you do for others. It's about finding something beautiful in others. Love is our mission. And mission is all about the relationships. Relationships that are mutually enriching, uplifting, and life-giving. Enter into one, and you will never be the same. What I am learning from our partners is that our relationship to one another enables us to be a better church in the United States. Global mission is about how we can better be church here. It's not about what happens over there. Global mission helps us to be a better church here. Partnerships encourage us and enrich us on our faith journey. I want to challenge Lancaster Seminary and our churches here in Pennsylvania to enter into renewed relationships with our partners in Japan. I know that the need for relationship is mutual. It may be that this relationship is just waiting to happen. Thank you.